Hey, this is Sad Song, and you are listening to Walking the Floor.
I'm walking the floor over you.
Walking the floor.
I'm walking the floor.
Walking the floor over you.
Hola, senores and senoritas. This is Chris Shiplett. Once again, you are listening to episode number 186 of your favorite podcast, Walking the Floor. Hope all is well wherever you are. I hope you're getting vaccinated. I haven't gotten vaccinated yet, but soon, it's coming. It's all coming. Once we do that, we can all get back to rocking and rolling. You know, normally in these little preambles, I like to talk about what's been going on, but I've been working a lot lately, and it's all top secret Foo Fighters stuff, so I can't really talk about it. But you'll find out soon enough. Whole lot going on. We've been doing stuff, creating content, as you have to do in these crazy times. And you know, here at Walking the Floor, I've just been pedal to the metal, one episode a week, getting through the backlog. Today's a great interview, but listen to these other ones that I still got in the can that I've got to get out and get to you. I got a bunch of them. I got Jay Bentley from Bad Religion. Is just waiting to be released to the world. Devin Gilfillian, great singer out of Nashville. Ward Davis. Corb Lund from the great nation of Canada. And let's not forget, motherfucking Del McCurry, bluegrass legend. I got all those in the can that I got to get to. And I got like a million other ones on tap that I haven't even scheduled yet because I'm just trying to get through those because I'm just so darn backed up with, you know, more interviews than time will allow. But I'm going to get to them. That's like, what is that? That's like six. That's like a month and a half. Five. It's like, you know, that's practically a month and a half of interviews right there. So I'm working, getting them out. And in the meantime, let me talk to you about my good friends over at Zounds.com. Zounds, did you know that Zounds.com has been around since 1996? It all started way back when as a little teeny retail shop, and now it's a big, giant online retailer, you know, one of the biggest musical instrument retailers on earth, and their whole freaking staff is musicians like us. There are people, so, get on over there to Zounds.com and get whatever you need. And right now, we're getting to the interview. Okay, I connected with my new friend Satsung through my old friend Bill Armstrong of Side One Dummy fame, because Side One Dummy is actually putting out the new Satsung record. That's not coming out until June, but the title track, All Right Now, is already up in the streaming services. And by the time this episode gets posted, there will be a new Satsung single out with featuring Trevor Hall. So make sure you go out and check that out. This is a very cool interview. This is a little more wide-ranging than my interviews normally get. We talked about music, of course, but we also talked about combat sports and MMA and boxing and U.S. foreign policy and politics and sobriety, and we talked about fishing. Talked about everything, man. Get ready. Buckle up. This is Satsung. Oh, wait, before I do that, I should also mention that after we did this interview, like a month or two after, Satsung interviewed me for his podcast, which is called Satsung Podcast. So, and that episode is already out. But that episode came out first. But actually, this interview was done before that. It's confusing. It's confusing, man. But go listen to that one after you get done listening to this one. This is Satsung on Walking the Floor. So how are you, man?
I'm good, dude. We just got masters of the new record, and I just came out to Chicago to help my brother move, and he has this huge fucking Pioneer sound system in his living room. So I just listened to the masters on this huge sound system.
Oh, that feels good.
Yeah, dude, it's definitely the coolest thing I've ever made.
Mastering is like it's such a strange part of the whole making an album process, because it's like, I don't know that I fully even understand what mastering exactly does, but it always,
it just
somehow takes your record and makes it sound like, you know, 20% better, you know?
Yeah. Well, what I think it is, is, you know how when you're listening to mixes, you'll like listen to it on headphones and you're like, oh, this is fucking perfect. But then you listen to it in your car and you're like, oh, the vocals are hot. This
right,
is off.
Right.
I think it's like a general, I don't know how or what they do, but from what I understand, it just like smooths it out and makes it sound the same or something.
You know what I've suffered from, and I don't know if everybody suffers from this. By the time I'm done making a record, like listening to the mixes of my record is like, it's like fucking needles in my eyes. Like, you know what I mean? It's like the yes. last thing on earth I want to listen to anymore is the thing that I've just spent weeks or months or whatever working on. You know what I mean?
Yeah, this record has been cool because it's our first time working with a label. So having, obviously I still gave mix notes and stuff like that, but previously it was me and my bass player and right-hand man Carl doing everything.
Yeah.
So yeah, exactly what you're saying. By the time it's like, I don't even know if this is a good mix. I've heard the song 8,000 times. I don't even care anymore. You know,
Is this, you said this is the first time that you've worked with a label. Is this is coming out through Side One Dummy?
Yeah, man. And really, really stoked.
Who, how'd you put your records out before?
We just did them independently, man. It would be like me and Carl would make everything. I'd produce and he would co-produce. I always joke that Carl was like my translator between me and like the computer world.
Uh-huh.
So I could like mumble out an idea of like, well, I want it to more kind of sound like this. And then he could, you know, make it sound like that.
Yeah.
And then really, dude, it would be me and my manager, you know, and I'd just be like, okay, well, here's $20,000. And I guess we'll just use this money to try and push a record. And it's really refreshing to have a team and have people that are like, yeah, this is what we do for a living, is push records. And
right,
it's been a really enjoyable process. I always have kind of been scared of the label thing, but dude, Side One has been so cool, and Bill and I have super hit it off. Thomas and I have always vibed, and it's been rad.
Like, where is the point that, because, like, you know, Side One Dummy, for people listening that don't know, like, Side One Dummy is an indie label, right? So in the sort of world of labels, there's like major labels and indie labels, big indie mm-hmm. labels, small indie labels, all that sort of. But what you're talking about with your first records, that's like indie, like self-release. So what is the point in, or where is the point in sort of building your band and building your touring fan base and all that, where you sort of realize, like, you know, we need more hands on deck. Like this isn't the way to get to that next level. Is like, we need to, you know, actually hook up with a label here.
Well, for me, it was, you know, I've always been very obsessed with owning everything, you know, and sharing ownership of my art with anyone has always been a tricky thing for me. And you know, I went very broke early on, making sure that I owned everything. I paid everybody up front, you know, and, you know, I've carved out a really nice living for myself being independent and doing it. And our streaming numbers have been really strong. But it's gotten to a point where I feel like, okay, I think, you know, I mean, there's those like unicorns like Chance the Rapper and shit like that can ride the indie train all the way to the top. But I'm just like, my gut was telling me that it was time. And when we started making this record, I knew I wanted to work with a label because I just feel like we've done a really great job, just me and my manager and, you know, as far as the artistic side, me and Carl and the boys, but it just felt like that it was the logical next step, that we'd kind of indied out our indie path and, you know, time to see if what would happen if we had some more people on the squad.
I mean, how do you do that? And I ask this, you know, just for my own curiosity, because it's something that I've never personally been able to crack, but how do you sort of, being a truly independent artist in that way, how do you make inroads with companies like Spotify and getting on playlists and all that stuff that like, that's how people do it now, you know, that's the pathway. And it's this sort of opaque thing that nobody quite will tell you, you know, how it all works or who you need to get to, or, you know what I mean? So how do you do that coming from a place of like, really like no power in the industry? Like when you're that indie, it's not like you're with a big major label that buys playlists and all that shit.
No, dude. So the story of Satsung is very weird, man, because we have been on, so we had like 17.5 million streams this year.
Wow.
And we've only been on one curated playlist, and that curated playlist accounted for 4,000 streams. So a very,
wow,
very nonsensical, you know what I mean? Very irrelevant playlist. So we've never been on a curated playlist, and we've never been, we don't have any of those relationships. We've just managed to get this small little cult following that is spreading shit organically, which is very rare. And it's something I'm super, super grateful for. So like I said, it was, you know, in transitioning to working with a label, it was like, okay, well, we've already kind of built this cool little thing for ourselves. So it's like, what would that look like with help? Cause yeah, I see it all the time. And I know like, so many artists struggle with that. Cause that's the thing, right? Is streaming now.
Yeah.
And it's like, and like you're saying, dude, anyone that has the ends with those playlists, they won't help anybody unless it's somehow going to benefit themselves. You know, it's like such a weird fucking world now.
Yeah.
I don't believe any of it, man. I've had this conversation with so many people, and over, I've been told like, it really, you just submit it and you know, it's totally organic and it's dependent on people liking it. And I'm like, if that's the truth, man, that is the only place in the music industry where that sort of thing exists. Because everywhere else
yeah, no is shit.
Related, you know what I mean?
No shit.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I don't believe that for a second either, dude. Because, like, so we just released this cover of a Randy Travis song just for the fuck of it.
Yeah.
And I was like, you know, I'll be transparent, dude. You know, I played it on tour as an encore and everybody flipped out. And I was like, fuck it, let's record this thing. And side one kind of had our back in releasing it. And I was like, this is the most perfect playlistable song ever. There's acoustic covers, you know, like Coffee House. I was just like, oh my God, this is going to crush. And we haven't gotten a fucking single one. So it's like, I think it absolutely is. Yeah. There's some fuckery afoot in the playlisting. But
I mean, you mentioned Randy Travis. In listening to your music, I mean, there's a lot of influences in there. You know, folk Americana stuff, reggae, hip hop, whatever. Like, are you, and I was listening to those mixes you sent me and there's like some really beautiful pedal steel in there. Who, I guess, are you a country fan? Like, where does the pedal steel slot into all that?
Well, it's a funny thing, man. You know, I grew up listening to punk rock and hip hop because I skateboarded, you know?
Yeah.
But my mom is originally from Montana, grew up on a ranch, and all she listened to is country. Literally all she listened to is country. So it's what I grew up on, you know, when I didn't have my own headphones in, that's what was playing in my house or in the car. And, you know, there was part of me that always loved the songwriting aspect of it, but the country that I always dug is really fucking old. You know, Hank Williams,
yeah,
Buck, you know, old Willie Nelson, all that shit. But, you know, when COVID hit, I found myself, you know, I live in the mountains of Southwest Montana. So I just had a year off for the first time in forever. And I was just getting out on the river all the time. And I started listening to all that old country, dude.
Mm.
And I was like, and now just as an adult songwriter, I really fell in love with it again, you know, like George Strait.
Yeah.
You know, just all the shit that I grew up listening to with my mom, as well as revisiting all the older stuff. But when I started writing the songs for this new record, I knew that we had to have a fiddle and I knew that we had to have a pedal steel. Like I could it felt like it was time to bring it full circle and go back to my like early, early roots, you know?
Did you make this record post COVID or pre COVID?
Post.
Post. Oh, okay. Wow. So you're getting it out pretty quick. How did that come together? How did you, like, do you go in with a band, or you said before it was just you and your buddy Carl? Was it just the two of you in the studio, or were you bringing in other people? How's that work?
So we did, I wrote all the songs by myself and started slowly sharing them with Carl. And then two of the songs, we played the Bluebird Theater in February. That was like pretty much our last headlining show. And we played two of the songs together as a band, but really I just was writing these songs, sending them to Carl. And then when COVID hit, I you know, I got the Apollo and I got a couple good mics. It was just like, all right, fuck it, let's start tracking a new record. And so we did vocals, some guitars, and then Carl did bass and harmonies. And then we flew all the boys to Montana and we rented a house in Paradise Valley. And then we tracked the rest of it there and added all the bells and whistles. But like Pedal Steel was done remotely by a dude named Ben Waligowski in Denver. Mm. And then Fiddle was done remotely as well by a dude named Tim Snyder in Reno. So for the most part, like Carl and I did the meat of it and then had the rest of the boys do everything else when we were all together, which was just like the coolest experience ever, you know, to like, we pretty much, this big house had like a studio barn that I think they do weddings in.
Oh, wow. Cool.
And we just turned it into a badass studio. So it was like, it was the full experience. It was really cool.
Do you guys track live? Do you sort of track as a band?
Not on this one. We didn't. We did everything separate. I do want to do that. Have you ever made a record like that where everything was just live tracked?
Yeah. Well, basic tracks. Yeah. 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 Like live, no click. That's how my last couple solo records have been with, you know, just rhythm section and two guitars and me trying to sing and get some rough stuff down, you know. I'm usually like, I'll go in and re-record most of my guitars and vocals just because, you know.
Yeah.
Because it's kind of shitty, but it's great for the rhythm tracks, you know. It's fantastic, yeah.
Yeah, I'd love to try a record like that. There's a cool studio in Asheville, North Carolina that's inside of a church. Mm. And I really think that would be a cool vibe to go do a live record in.
You mentioned a second ago, like, sort of getting out into the outdoors and stuff. Well, once you had time on your hands because of the lockdown, like what, I've been through Montana a million times on tour, but I've only ever been up there once, like on vacation, at like a dude ranch thing. And we went like riding horses and fishing and all that sort of stuff. It's the only time I've ever gone fly fishing. It was amazing.
It's fun, isn't it?
Yeah. Like, do you get out? Like, do you have hobbies like that? Are you fishing and
yeah, lots of them
outdoorsy stuff?
Yeah, you know, prior to music, man, I was kind of just a dirt bag. You know, like I worked on
there's
the ski
headline.
Hill.
There's the yeah. headline.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I worked on the ski hill and I rock climbed in the summer and was always backpacking and camping and doing alpine climbs and shit like that. Mm. But once I started touring, as you know, it just kind of, especially when you're trying to get something off the ground, your life just kind of comes to a halt and everything yeah. else takes a backseat to building a brand and a band. And, with all this time off, you know, I reconnected with some friends and I was getting out on the river and fishing, you know, once, at least once, usually twice a week, started rock climbing again.
Yeah.
Helping out my buddy Ivan on his ranch. And
are you fly fishing out there?
Yeah. Yeah. 100%.
Oh man.
It's kind of sacrilege to do anything else.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Mm-hmm. That makes sense. I've been fishing a lot over the course of this break and I was never, you know, I fished when I was a kid on camping trips and stuff, but, and then started fishing with my kids a little bit. Once I started having kids, but I never really spent a lot of time doing it and have really like gone down the saltwater fishing rabbit
Ooh,
quite a bit.
I've like, never I, done that.
Yeah. It's fun, man. I was just like fishing off the beach, but kind of, we have a little place up in Santa Barbara and I was just spending a lot of time at the beach and catching little surf perch and stuff. And then, you know, you can just kind of do that thing where you're like, wonder what's out there in the kelp. And then, you know, I out there on my stand up paddleboard and then fish a little bit like that. And then I got a kayak not too long ago. So I've been out there on the kelp in the kayak and like it's
that
it's,
scares
it's,
me, dude.
It's it, I know what you mean because there's like some big things with teeth out there for sure. But it's fun because like it, I really don't know what the fuck I'm doing. You know what I mean? And I'm just like trying to figure like why didn't that work? You know, why did I just get skunked five times in a row? And what am yeah. I doing wrong here? And then, you know, like, it's really like, it's fun to like, it's fun to dip your toe into shit that you don't really have any expertise in whatsoever.
Yeah. And then you meet, you know, same thing for me, dude, you know, I'll go out, you know, four times in a row and not catch a fish. And then I have buddies that fish the same spot on the same day and post pictures on Instagram with fish the size of their fucking yeah, arms. Like, and I'm like, what did I do? What did totally. I do wrong?
Yeah, it's exactly it, man. It's so funny. Bill, well, maybe one of these days you can take me fly fishing, give me some tips, because a buddy of mine
Anytime.
Here in LA has been trying to get me to go get a setup for that, get up into the Sierras, and
it's go so find fun, it. Man.
No, I'm sure that I totally, having done it the one time up in Montana, I totally get how people just get obsessed with that. There's like a
thing
to it, you know?
Yeah, there's an art to doing it even when you're not catching fish. It's real active. But what's really cool about it is, especially with dry flies, it's not this thing that's happening under the water. It's on top of the water most of the time. Mm. So you're, you know, sometimes you can even see the fish. So you get your bug to float by the fish.
Right.
And they hit it. So it's just a super interactive, you know, it's so fun, man.
I tell you that I had a funny moment. It was like me and one of my sons, who was very young at that point, because this was a few years ago, and we had like a fishing guide, and we're on a little boat, and we're drifting down the river, and I'm trying to figure out how to do it, and I'm like casting or whatever, and the hook just comes, and I had sunglasses on too, and it just comes and just right into my eyelid, and I was like, oh, ow! And the guy that was our guide, it was like straight out of like a Will Ferrell movie or something. He just goes, whoa, I've never seen that before.
Dude, when we had all the boys up to make the record, we all get out on the raft. My buddy Nate took us out, and it didn't dawn on me that people aren't used to being on a you know, a 5-person inflatable raft where someone's flipping a fly around all directions.
Sure.
And everybody was pretty stoned, but you know, at one point I'm like sitting there casting and trying to catch fish, and then I start realizing that my band is like diving around on the boat, you know, and I have to assure him, like, guys, you know, I'm not a fucking professional fisherman, but I assure you I won't hook you, you know. Right, and I realized like these guys were freaking out the whole time I'm fishing, thinking they were gonna get hit.
That's funny. Hey, I think Bill mentioned to me that you do some MMA fighting. Is that,
yes, sir.
I wasn't sure. Is that something that you do like professionally? Like, or how do you, do tell.
Yeah. You know, so about 4 years ago, I started doing Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. Well, I went into the gym just to box was the initial plan. It was just like to give me something to do, you know, outside of music. And I grew up wrestling. And when I got to the gym, it was a predominantly, you know, a jiu-jitsu gym. And the only dudes that were really doing striking were pro fighters, which are all very scary dudes.
Sure.
So I was like, okay, well, maybe I'll get into jiu-jitsu. My brother-in-law, who I'm staying with now, is a really good jiu-jitsu practitioner. So I was like, yeah, I'll give this a go. And I just got bit by the bug, man. I got fucking hooked on it. You know, I became obsessed really, really quick. And then as jiu-jitsu got better, I started being like, okay, well, maybe I'll revisit striking. And then, especially with all this time off, it's just like, you know, I teach 2 days a week now. Mm. And I do striking 2 days a week, jiu-jitsu 4 days a week. And it just, yeah, it's just a huge part of my life, man.
Like, was having a background in wrestling, did that... Like, there's a lot of overlap there with jiu-jitsu, isn't there?
I thought there would be, but I was shocked at how little there was. You know, like, I always think of, well, yeah, man. When I think of, like, the very first time that I rolled, in my head, that's what I thought, right? Like, dude, I wrestled for, like, 10 years. Like, there's got to be some crossover here.
Sure.
And I was completely humiliated, you know? Like, it was crazy how little crossover there was. I mean, it made learning easier because there's just, like, a body awareness of, like,
yeah,
understanding the components of grappling. But dude, it was crazy how little crossover there actually
interesting.
Was.
Interesting. Because now,
especially in a gi,
I'm a boxing fan. I don't know too much about MMA, but I've been, you know, around like gyms and stuff where both are happening. And so correct me if I'm wrong here, but would you say the core disciplines of MMA are like jiu-jitsu, like Greco-Roman wrestling or college wrestling, boxing, kickboxing, more or less?
Yes.
Right.
Yep. Yeah. And then you have some guys that have managed to sprinkle in other shit, but you have to have the ones you just mentioned. You have to, like, you can throw in, you know, some, you know, if someone's got like a black belt in Taekwondo, but they've been trained by a good Muay Thai coach, they're able to kind of sneak in some of those crazy kicks. But yeah, really it's Muay Thai wrestling and jiu-jitsu are the, you must have those.
Well, here's the thing. This is what I was kind of leading to is, when I think of combat sports, like kind of all combat sports require, I would think, you know, a certain level of aggro, you know, so, or at least a certain level of being able to tap into your aggro, you know, to do it. And
And then, and so knowing that you do that is here. And then I listen to your music and I don't hear that like at all.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Those two things seem a little at odds with each other. So how's that work out?
Yeah, I get that a lot. You know, I don't really feel aggro when I train, and if I'm aggro, I suck, you know? So it's real weird, but for me, if I'm sparring or rolling, you know, my best path forward to be successful is to stay mellow and to stay in a relaxed place. And for me, I think the biggest thing I get for it is if you can stay calm, collected, and manage your thoughts under the threat of violence.
Yeah.
You start getting really good at managing all of that shit, you know, under the stress of just about anything else.
Right. I mean, that really is that is such a big part. I mean, I've never wrestled or grappled or anything, but I've trained for years and sparred a ton and all that stuff with boxing. And it is amazing how, like, the minute you start to panic or forget to breathe or get too worked up, that's when you start taking shots.
And you see it, you know, you see it, like the Diaz brothers are a great example of that, of like getting people super pissed, right? They get them super pissed and then they get out of their comfort zone and then they put in that work,
right?
You know?
Yeah.
So there's some guys that specialize in that, of like, you know, yeah, they're where their whole game plan is just like, no, dude, I'm going to get you pissed so you lose your composure and then I'll beat you up.
Yeah, it's the mental side of the whole thing, which is kind of most of it oftentimes. Just out of curiosity, I don't know if you watch any boxing stuff, but did you watch that that Tyson Jones Jr. debacle?
Yeah, I did, man.
Weeks ago?
I did, and I was really, really impressed with Tyson, man. He looked really good.
Yeah, I mean, he definitely got himself in shape. I can't really say the same for Roy Jones. Didn't look to be as in shape.
But, yeah, they went to different doctors.
Ain't that the truth?
yeah, that shit with Tyson was so funny. I was telling all my homies that. They're like, man, he got in really good shape, and that only took like 4 months. It was like my brother said last night, he goes, yeah, man, I'll give you a hint. It rhymes with steroids. Yeah. You know, but yeah, good for him, man. You know, just skill-wise, he still had the bob and weave. You know, it's funny because Roy Jones Jr. was probably my favorite growing up.
Yeah.
But the thing with his style, it relied a lot on his speed and athleticism.
Absolutely.
And when you start creeping towards 50, that speed and athleticism wasn't there. And you could see after that first round, dude, he was tanked already. He was dying.
Yeah. I gotta say, like, I bought it. I watched it. You know, I think on one hand, I get the idea that, you know, these guys doing something they love is cool and, you know, all that sort of thing. I had a much more cynical view of the whole thing. I can't say I enjoyed it. I thought they just looked, you know, I don't want to see two of the best that ever were out there fucking gasping and holding each other for 8 rounds or, you know, whatever. But, and I'm more of the mindset, like, if you want to see Tyson in his prime, just jump on YouTube.
Yeah,
no shortage of highlight reel stuff, but you know, whatever. That's the world we live in. It's going to be Floyd Mayweather versus YouTube stars and shit like that. It's going to become the new norm, and I don't think any of it is particularly relevant to like the core of the sport. But
dude, who blew me away? I just watched. I was getting tattooed a few months back, and I watched the Lopez versus Lomachenko.
Oh yeah.
That kid's got 6 belts now.
I know. That's insane. And you know,
he's 21.
I always, and you see this time and time again, and it just, as a fight fan, is so frustrating. I always said that the thing that's going to undo Lomachenko is not going to be his skill or anything like that. It could eventually be his age. You know, everybody gets old. But it's the thing that we see over and over again where guys just are chasing bigger fights and they move up to unnatural weight classes. I mean, it just happens over and over again. It's just fucking stupid. Like, the man is physically not a lightweight and should not be competing there. And it's like, you know, I get that there's money in the higher weight classes, but it's like, why go fight some badass motherfucker who's huge for that fucking weight class? It just, to me, it was such a physical mismatch. It's like, I don't know, man. I thought
makes you wonder about the
fantastic.
Oh yeah, he looks so good, man. And I think the thing too that gets tricky for a guy like Loma too is it was like, you know, he lost that fight and still made $50 million more than Lopez.
Right.
So it's like,
well, there's that. So there's certainly an argument to be made.
Yeah. It was like, fuck, even if I lose, you know, my great grandkids are going to still have money.
Yeah. Well, there's truth there. And I, you know, shouldn't poo poo anybody in an industry that is not geared for fighters to ultimately be wealthy. You know, to go out and make a buck is, you know, it's probably even harder than the music industry, you know?
Yeah. No shit.
Yeah.
No shit.
Hmm. Well, let's back up a little bit. Where did you grow up?
So I was born in Montana, but I moved to Des Moines, Iowa when I was in like second or third grade. So I grew up there, and then I moved to Chicago when I was like 17. So yeah, man, just in Des Moines, just pretty much skateboarding and, you know, smoking weed and partying. And
what was that like? Like, what was your family like? Like, how did you get into music? When did you start playing music? Like, how did you sort of wind up on that path?
I think I got my first guitar when I was in like sixth grade. I always just loved music, man. You know, and my first goal when I started playing guitar was, I just wanted to start a punk rock band.
Mm.
So I didn't have aspirations to be a phenomenal musician. I wanted to be able to fucking play bar chords and yell, you know.
Who were you listening to at that time? Like, what kind of stuff?
Bad Religion, Anti-Flag, Circle Jerks. Yes. That whole era I really loved the, you know, I always got good grades too without really trying, but I've always been a big history guy. So I really liked the intellectual punk rock, you know, like Bad Religion is just hands down my favorite punk rock band of all time. U.S. Bombs.
Yeah. 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 I love Bad Religion. I mean, Bad Religion, a hugely important band to me too. And it's funny you say that about the intellectual side, cause they definitely like, you needed a dictionary and a thesaurus and some things, you know, an encyclopedia set to get through their lyrics at the time.
Yeah, you know,
I definitely learned some big words from Bad Religion over the years, that's for sure.
The thing that I really like too is you know, there's those guys out there like homie from Bad Religion, you know, he's a political science professor at Cornell.
Yeah.
And you know, I've seen him get into some funny internet arguments. Tom Morello is another one where he's like, so he had said something about Trump and the guy was like, oh, another musician, you know, out here, you know, pretending to be a political expert. And he goes, listen, man, you don't have to have a doctorate in political science from Harvard, you know that Trump's a jackass. But as someone that has a doctorate in political science from Harvard, I can confirm that he is a jackass, you know? So it's like, I was always really attracted to, and same thing with hip hop. You know, when I got into hip hop, it was all Mos Def, Common, Talib Kweli.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah, man. I just liked smart music with it that was saying something, you know?
Yeah. Well, that's such a thing in what we do. If you step out from the sort of the margins of acceptable topics and discourse, you immediately get the shut up and shut the fuck up and play thing.
Yep.
I like when people push back against that. It's good.
Well, it's important, man, because that's kind of, in my opinion, dude, that's always kind of what art has been important for, you know?
Yeah.
Is to reach out to people, whether it's on politics or emotional shit or whatever, it's a lifeline to people to go, oh man, you know, I'm not crazy for feeling this way. And that was always what I really got from punk rock and hip hop. You know, I grew up in a neighborhood that was predominantly black and Bosnian refugees.
Bosnian refugees, really?
Yeah, it was crazy. And I didn't have the context for how the fuck they all got to Des Moines until years later. You know, I became to understand the situation in Kosovo and everything. But I mean, bro, I was in middle school and all of a sudden was just like, oh, me and my brother and like two other people are the only white kids on the bus.
Right.
And there was a big Section 8 apartment complex about two blocks from our house. And that was where they all moved. But yeah, Des Moines and a couple other Midwestern cities, Kansas City was one, that just, that was where they went for some reason, you know, that was where the government sent them.
Yeah.
And you know, it was just interesting to see hip hop connect with these Bosnian refugees, right? It's music about struggle. And so when they found American hip hop, I just saw them connect with it, you know, and I had a really shitty grew up in a shitty household, you know, where I was abused and, you know, on punk rock and hip hop, they connected with me so deep because it was struggle music, you know? And, right. and for me, the music's a lifeline to people, man. You know, so that whole, when people say shit like that, shut up and play, man, you don't have, you know, the right. I'm an American citizen, dude. I have every right to critique anything I want to. And this is my medium for it. Right. I don't talk shit in the break room of my cubicle job. I make art about it, you know?
Yeah. You know, that's really interesting. Like, do you have any, like, were the Bosnian refugees that wound up in Des Moines, were those like, you know, people who, if they had stayed behind, would have been victimized by, you know, the
yeah, and some of them
at that moment.
Yeah, man. And some of them were, you know, I had a good buddy named Samir that was just kind of always around. And I came to know a lot of them pretty well just from living in the neighborhood. But this kid, Samir in particular, man, you know, after about a year of kicking it with us, he started telling us stories, man. And, you know, it put a lot into perspective for me. You know, I really love America, man. And I've gotten a lot of blowback from it recently, which is a really weird thing. But to hear the struggle of people that grow up in a war-torn country, they go, yeah, man, our fucking water didn't work. Like, these bombs came, I lost half my family, and the water wouldn't work. There right. was no electricity. And right. you're just like, holy shit, that would not fucking happen here. You know what I mean? That is not.
It's a different level of struggle, that's for sure. Yeah,
it is.
It's interesting because I think in a lot of that, like I think especially in the way that the sort of polarization around discourse nowadays that we're all living through, it seems to get lost. You know, I'm like probably by most people's standards, extremely left wing or whatever. But mm-hmm. it gets lost. It becomes like you're anti-American. It's like, no. My critique is from a pro. Like I'm critiquing the system because it doesn't help the people. You know what yeah. I mean? That's not being anti-American. It's being anti, you know, corporate power.
Yeah. I love America so much that I want it to run more efficiently.
Right. You know? For its actual citizens, you know, for yes. the masses, yes. for the vast majority of the humans that live here. I mean, that's, which always kind of drives me nuts. Cause I get a lot of that myself, you know, from fuck you commie, shut up. I'm like, well, I'm not a commie, but I just
yeah
think we could have a more sane sort of economy, you know, that works.
Yeah. And I think, you know, I think that my biggest thing, man, of recently, I want to facilitate in people learning to have discourse again. You know, I had a guy named Tim Kennedy on my podcast, who was a you know, former top two contender for the middleweight belt in the UFC, active mm-hmm. Green Beret, Army Ranger, sniper, bad motherfucker, you know, probably the most dangerous human being on the planet. And he was breaking down, you know, I had proposed to him like, yeah, man, I've always been a proponent of, okay, well, we spend all this money on the military. What if we reallocated some of that money here? And he goes, Obama did that. And here's what that was like for me. He's like, you know, I spent 8 years chasing ISIS into these small little villages, into the mountains and out of major cities where they could not recruit and they could not impose serious, serious, serious oppression on people. You know, we hear oppression in America. We think of systemic racism and stuff like that. You know, oppression in those countries with groups like ISIS are, you know, we're going to kill your family. And if you don't join us, we'll kill you too. And he said, you know, I just got to a place where I would be like, okay, this group is moving down the mountain and they're headed towards a major city. And here's the gear list that I need. And here's how many team members I need. And we can stop this now. And during the Obama administration, they're like, yeah, well, we can give you a third of that. So he's like, I watched over, you know, 8 years of work and then watched over another 8 year period, watch them infiltrate and take over whole countries because the funding wasn't there to stop them. So it's like, for me, it's just really important that we talk to people that know more than us about certain situations, you know, and that really opened my eyes of like, well, shit, I guess I'm not a Special Forces Green Beret. And I didn't know that was that.
Yeah, situation. but it's a bit of a fallacy as well. I mean, I would push back pretty strongly against that idea. A, the Obama administration did not curtail defense spending. So that's,
they changed just, it. Yeah.
No truth to it whatsoever, but it also sort of, it overlooks, and you know, I don't know the guy that you're talking to and I'm sure he's a smart guy or whatever, but it overlooks the fact that we, you know, our foreign policy created the conditions that created ISIS to begin with.
So yes.
If you really want to kind of want to solve the underlying issues, you have to pull the onion back quite a bit, you know?
Yes, and you see how I could just already see you, him, and I sitting down and being like, okay, well, let's lay it out on the table. And I right. think the key is the, like, even what you just said there. I don't know your friend, but I'm pretty sure he's a smart guy. And like that, rather than like, no, fuck that motherfucker, you know? It's like, you know, like, fuck what he said. Fuck right. that guy.
Yeah, yeah,
fuck,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Where it's like, you know, I deleted my Facebook and, oh man, it's given me such peace. And then last week I was like, I was like, no, man, well, the election's over. I'll pop back on. And,
you're like, no, you know, it's got
no, worse. Yeah, dude, it took all but like 3 days before I was like, nope, we're deleting again.
Yeah.
But I think like you just said that really well, man, is it's like everything is so nuanced and complex. I think the best thing we can do for America is learn how to talk to each other again. And if someone has different ideas than you, that doesn't make them a communist. That doesn't make them a fucking racist piece of shit. It's like, oh yeah, you might just right. have a completely different life experience and scope.
Yeah. Well, you know? Said. Well said. On a completely, well, I guess it's all related. Can we talk about sobriety a little bit? Is that something?
Yeah,
I don't
please.
Know if that's something you talk about or not. But I read an interesting thing that you said about, and I really connected with this. Yeah, I've been sober for just past the 14-year mark.
Ooh, congrats, dude!
Yeah, I got a couple. You know, I got a moment. But I read somewhere where you said that before you got sober, you had no discipline, and I think about mm-hmm. that all the time in my own life and experience. But do you think of, like, do you connect songwriting to almost like having a therapeutic function in your mm-hmm. life?
Yeah. It's funny. I get asked all the time where my, like, where creativity comes from. And I think for me, it's all connected. You know, after I got sober, as I'm sure you experienced too, you kind of realize like, oh man, I have a lot of time on my hands when I'm not fucked up. So you start trying to find things, whether that's boxing or jujitsu or exercise yeah. or fishing. You start to like, and for me, I realized, you know, when I was a drunk that I was just a mess. You know, I had no control of my life or the idea of discipline of like, okay, well, I'm going to wake up at this time and I'm going to set a morning routine. And you know, I would say creativity isn't even worked into my plan. As far as like a routine or anything like that, but it's a byproduct of it because when my body's running properly and I'm emotionally healthy, and I'm doing all the right things, it just kind of comes,
right.
you know?
Yes.
They're like, it's like the, what's the word I'm looking for? Like the portal just kind of stays open, you know?
Yes. That is so true. I mean, that is one of the best pieces of advice about songwriting I ever got was like, just do it all the time and mm-hmm. do it when you feel uninspired. And eventually, you know, you just, those muscles get strong and it just happens without having to, it gets a lot more effortless over time. I feel it's interesting, man. I feel really like exactly the same way. I look back at my younger self and think, God, I wasted so much time. And now I'm like obsessed with not wasting time. I'm also like I like mm-hmm. to live like I'm a dog. Like you got to run your dog out so he fucking mellows out at night. Like I'm the exact same way.
Yeah.
Go me too. All day long so I can fucking be at the night just be like, oh fuck, you know.
Yep. Yeah, I'm the same way, man. I'm the same way. Yeah. You know, I heard Bob Weir say something one time that I connected so deeply with. You know, man. Growing up, I was. You know, whether it was from my dad or my teachers or administration, I was always kind of told that shit wasn't going to work out for me, you know, because of where I came from economically, because of my home life. And then, you know, I went to pretty much was like a charter school. You know, I went to school with a bunch of fucking rich kids where, you know, telling teachers that I wanted to be an artist, they were like, no. and you know, the only thing that's ever made a way for me, you could take that many, many ways, that's ever made a way for me is my creativity. So I've kind of made a deal with it where I'm just at its beck and call. And if my creative energy bings me at 3 a.m., then I wake up and I answer the phone. Or if it's like, you know, I tell this story, the title track for the new record, I'd just gotten home from a 6-week tour and had just got all my shit inside and was laying on the couch with my wife. And the song came and I was like, fuck, babe, I'm really sorry. I know I've been gone for almost 6 weeks, but I have to go open the guitar case. I have this song, like it's coming right now. You know, like I have to go write it down. And I think that's an important thing too, of like, if you make time for it, it'll make time for you.
Yeah.
You know, and always just being available to being like, nope, I have to drop everything and write.
Dude, that is so funny. I've had that experience so many times over the years of like, you're in bed and you're all comfortable and you're about to doze off and so, like a line pops into your head and you're like, and I'll always go through that thing and like, I'll remember that in the morning.
And you never do.
And you never
and you
do.
Never will.
And so you got it. You have to get up and drag your ass downstairs and get your fucking notebook out and write it down and chase it. It's always better when you do it in the moment, you know?
Yeah, I think of how cool it would be, you know, and obviously, you know, there's ills that come with like, you know, the level of fame of like, or fuck the virtuosity of somebody like John Mayer. Cause there, dude, there's been times where I have like a whole composition that's playing in my head when I'm laying in bed. And I was like, man, I wish I was a good enough musician and had the capacity to just be like, all right, I'm going to go downstairs and just compose this now.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
But I couldn't, you know, I couldn't play half of what was playing in my head, but
sure. Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. I mean, that is the hard thing of, or, you know, one of the challenges of songwriting is getting that thing in your head. You know, onto your hard drive, you know, and I find usually it's usually goes somewhere better, but sometimes you get halfway through it and you're like, I don't even know what the fuck I was thinking.
yeah, this is trash. Yeah. Well, what's funny, man, is what's really special about this record that we're releasing next year that I've never had before. Was I was writing all of these songs and I could hear them finished in my head. Even when it was just me on an acoustic guitar, I could hear them finished.
Yeah.
I've never really been able to do that before. It was always kind of like, yeah, okay, cool. We have the framework for a song and now we'll build it. So like what I kept telling the boys was like, fuck man, I cannot wait until you guys hear this record. Like I've been listening to it for 6 months already. And that was what I was always telling the label too, was at the beginning we, you know, they were suggesting a couple producers that weren't really in the style that I was hearing the record in my head. And I eventually had to just be like, no, man, I have to produce this because I've already been listening to it. It's already done.
Yeah.
We just have to put it down, you know? Which is cool. I've never experienced that before. And maybe that's a sign of, you know, growth as an artist or something. But like for me, I never have heard songs finished before until this record, you know, I could hear everything in my head.
Oh, that's a good feeling. So, and the album's called All Right Now, right?
Yep.
And what day does it come out? When's it coming out?
I believe the date that we've set is June 21st.
Oh, shit. So it's a ways off in the distance. Okay.
Ways off. Yeah. And that's the other thing that's been really weird. Dude, usually I'm like, okay, the mastering deadline's at 8:00. We have to get this through because we're releasing it in 2 months, you know, and I just have no fucking clue what I'm doing. You know, it's just like,
yeah, sure.
Finish it and get it out, where it feels really good to be like, no, the record's done, we're gonna do singles and videos and every, you know, like there's a plan. You know,
well, I hope by the time it comes out you're able to get back out on the road. I hope we're all able to get back out on the road by the time it comes out. And
let me ask you this, dude. This has to be really weird for a band of your size. Like, you know, I just keep thinking like a band like Foo Fighters size, like, fuck man, when are you guys going to be able to do shows again? Cause it's pretty hard to get 8,000 people together in a room.
Well, that's the, you know, $1 million question. I think everybody's trying to figure out. Yeah. I mean, I hear from a lot of people, you know, like our management and stuff, seems pretty solid that touring will come back in some capacity next summer. And I say in some capacity because I've heard the idea that it'll be like outdoor gigs. Like you'll play like a shed, but at like half capacity. You know what I mean? So, so it'll be interesting. So it'll be like, who knows? By then, you know, with a vaccine and everything, it depends. There's so many variables that who knows? But I don't know if it's going to be harder for bands like us because, you know, we'll be able to, if you go out and play a place that holds 25,000 people and put 10 in it, you could probably make those numbers work. But if you're a band that's playing a 500 cap room, and you're only allowed to put 100 people in it, like, I don't think those numbers are for people. So I actually kind of view it the opposite. I think bands like us will be the first ones back, and it'll be a lot harder
interesting
for everybody else. You know what I mean? So, but who knows? What do I know? I'm just a dumb dropout guitar player, you know?
Yeah, right. Yeah, that's what's funny too, man, is it's like, yeah, I've just fully, you know, same thing. My management is always like, well, what I'm hearing is this. And I'm like, dude, unless that motherfucker works for the CDC, he doesn't know what the fuck he's talking about, you know?
Exactly. It's all just fucking, you know, like roll the dice.
Yep. We'll see what happens. Yep, that's exactly it.
Yeah, well, fingers crossed, hopefully sooner than later. Well, dude, thanks. Yeah. Thanks a million for fucking sitting down with me today. This was really fun. It's good to good to meet you. I know we've been texting for a minute talking about doing this, so it was good to, you know.
Yeah, well, my toddler broke my brand new MacBook Pro, so it got sent off to Apple, and when it returns, man, we'll have you on my podcast
because I'd
love to dig into you.
The joys of fatherhood.
Yeah, man.
Awesome, dude. Well, take care, brother.
Yeah, you too, bro. We'll talk soon.
Yeah, for sure.
See you, man.
All right, that was Sat Sung on Walk on the Floor. Make sure you go check out his new single and look for his new record, All Right Now, coming out in June on Side One Dummy. And we will see you in a week with God knows who, but it's going to be good, I promise. Adios, amigos! Now.